Welcome to Real Money with David Holland, the show that focuses on real people, real problems, and real solutions. David is a certified financial planner with over 20 years of financial experience. And because he actually provides advice to clients on a daily basis, our hyperactive compliance department wants us to tell you that David Holland is an investment advisor representative of Holland Advisory Services, a registered investment advisory firm. He also offers insurance and annuity products through Holland Insurance Services. Holland Advisory Services and Holland Insurance Services are separate affiliated companies that share common ownership under Holland Financial. Commentary given during this radio program is usually pretty smart, but should not be considered investment, insurance, tax, or legal advice. Views expressed concerning specific securities should not be considered an offer to buy or sell. Investment advice and financial planning services can only be given after an analysis of an individual's situation. Only if you hire David and his firm to help you, and only available where Holland Advisory Services is registered or exempt from registering. Here he is, David Holland.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, you know what? I was reading one of my favorite publications, the Wall Street Journal, the other day, and a column or an article struck me, and I said, I need to get that guy on the radio program with us and talk to you today about stock splits. What are they? Are they good? They bad? They're indifferent? Do they make a difference on your portfolio? Should you do anything about them when your stock splits? So to answer all of those questions and the meaning of life, Maxwell Murphy.
Hi, David. I'll do my best with the meaning of life, but I should have some good answers about stock splits.
I knew you'd love that. Maxwell Murphy. He is Maxwell Murphy of the Wall Street Journal's CFO Journal, and he is also a big Notre Dame fan. Is that right?
That is correct. That's my alma mater.
All right. Outstanding. No, and I'm not supposed to mention the recent loss to Pittsburgh.
No, probably not.
All right. I won't
but it did
that.
Happen. We can't pretend it didn't.
Well, what do they say? You win some, you lose some, right?
Yeah, we went to the national championship game last year, so
hey!
I didn't know if that was ever going to happen in my lifetime, even getting that far. So.
Well, a lot of teams don't do that, so there you go. Well, I wanted to have Max on because he can speak to us today about stock splits. So I'm a CPA, Max, and I cut my teeth on, you know, doing accounting 101 and doing the journal entries, and of course now doing investment work. I look at it from a different standpoint for my clients when a company's stock splits, but your article struck me that I said, you know, this is something we need to talk a little bit about. So if you don't mind, Max, let's do this. Let's kind of start with some of the basics, help people understand what's going on with a stock split. And then part of what you spoke to in your article was, you know, when is it good? When is it bad? How can it affect people?
Well, sure. You know, the process has been around for decades, and the thinking goes that especially back a few decades ago in the 80s and the 70s and before that, the investing world was dominated mostly by mom-and-pop investors who had their brokerage account, and they were usually buy-and-hold long-term investors. And what would happen is stocks would climb as a company performed well, and once they started to get up around the $100 range, they would notice a real drop-off in the amount of interest from mom-and-pop investors. And really, it's a psychological thing. And I think that persists today, where you have the thinking that I don't want to just buy for my $1,000 investment one share of Google or Priceline, but if it were $100 or $50, I would probably buy 10 or 20 of them for that same amount. It's really more of a psychological thing. The neat thing about it is that it has to be all psychological, because you as an accountant background would know that if you split your stock, you're halving the share price and doubling the amount of shares, so the ultimate value, market value of the company should not change.
Yep, day before and day after a split, on the balance sheet of that company, it should be the same exact thing.
That's exactly right, and you know, the balance sheet, every line of it would be unchanged except for the amount of shares outstanding that are used to calculate earnings per share. But the practice has really faded, especially since the bubble burst, the dot-com bubble burst, because what can happen is a company can split its stock, and let's say they go, like VF Corp wants to do, go from around $200 to around $50. The CFO, Robert Shearer, told me they want to make it a little bit more attractive to retail investors. The worry would be that you split your stock, and then circumstances out of your control, like a financial crisis or a crash, then take a big chunk out of your stock price, which then can make your stock trade so low that it actually has the reverse effect and makes larger investors not want to buy it because of the risk that it could go even further lower and possibly even at some point be at risk to be delisted and kicked off an exchange.
Yeah, you don't want your $10, $20 stock to turn into a penny stock.
That's exactly right. And well, speaking of penny stocks, the ADP CFO, Jan Sigmund, said, you know, that they're not considering stock splits because they don't really see any need to attract penny stock investors or small fish.
Well, there you go.
Well, and most companies, you know, realize that institutional investors, they've dominated the market as the financial crisis and all the bad news that used to make them, good news that used to make them tune into CNBC turned into bad news that made retail investors flee both the market and CNBC. And most companies find their shares 70 to 80 to 90% or more owned by institutions, which really don't care in the least what price of stock is unless it's too low for them to buy.
Well, and Max, you make another good point because, you know, everybody forgets this, and it's something I am always reminding people, is that when we had the financial crisis and we had all of those retail investors heading for the door and selling, of course, a lot of the buyers who had a lot different investment horizon were the institutional investors.
Absolutely right.
For every sale, there's got to be a buyer, right? So, I mean, so a lot of that, I can see that whole shift, and they couldn't, you're right, they couldn't care any less about what the per price they're buying in lots, you know, the difference in terms of the size of the lots by the institutional investors. These are the big, you know, the big pension companies, the big foundations, these big organizations, people with lots of money versus the individual investor trying to plan for their retirement or just trying to accumulate to buy something in the future. Two totally different investment strategies.
Indeed, and I think you see now that as companies have sort of figured out this new paradigm, this new dynamic, if you will, they are caring less about share buybacks. And there was a little, it seemed like they tried to have a little bit of a comeback 2005, 6, 7, but then the financial crisis really soured almost all demand for it, and we've only seen, you know, 10 to 15 companies on the S&P 500 do it any year in the past about 5 or 6. But the odd thing is the companies that do it, it seems that more often than not, that psychological effect with retail shareholders, that perceptual sign of confidence in the company's stock by doing it, has led to those companies outperforming the broader market, even with the 25% year-over-year gains we're looking at now.
Very good. Well, these are all things that we need to be thinking about when we look at these stocks, and that's why I wanted to have Max come on. Let's do this, and we'll rejoin our conversation with Maxwell Murphy. Stay right there.
Are you gambling with too much money invested in the stock market? How can you tell?
It's simple. The rule of 100. Take your age and subtract it from 100. The result is how much you might want to keep in the market. The rest should be off the table, invested in something safe. Every rule has an exception, but the rule of 100 is a good starting point to determine if your portfolio is out of balance. Holland Financial is ready to help. Call 888-747-PLAN to schedule your free consultation or visit us at davidholland.com.
And welcome back. Yeah, our special guest today is Maxwell Murphy. He's covered Wall Street for 14 years, includes a dozen as a general assignment reporter, a columnist on the special retail beat for Dow Jones Newswires. He's done a lot of things, but he became senior editor in 2011 of CFO Journal, and they have a great relationship with Wall Street Journal. And we're glad to have Max on the program helping us kind of sort through this whole thing of stock splits. I wanted to go back to something you said before the break, and it got me thinking, Max, is, are you seeing or have you seen a relationship between stock splits or reverse stock splits and buybacks?
Well, and that's funny. You know, I ask CFOs this all the time because it intuitively does not really compute with me that you would do a stock split while you have a buyback program outstanding.
Right.
It seems counterintuitive, but I haven't met a CFO that minds it because they kind of separate the two concepts. And
okay.
And the ones that are still in favor of stock splits, the few, the proud,
the proud, the dreamers.
Exactly. They say that they are going after that psychological perception that it's a better to buy a stock and that it's a real strong show of confidence because obviously it means you don't think that there's any danger in the world of your stock losing some value in the near term. And so that works. But on the other hand, you can see what can go awry with a buyback, with a stock split because of how much they wind up having to buy. Take, for example, Home Depot. And now if you can find me, you'd be hard-pressed to find me a company that's performing better right now in today's America than Home Depot. And their CFO, Carol Tomei, is about as sharp as they get. And, you know, I was talking to her, and they had a series of buybacks between 1982 and 1999. They split its stock 13 times for a total of about 342 shares for one.
Wow.
And things were great until the bubble burst, and their stock price went down, down, down. They've spent something like $42 billion in buybacks since 2002, and they still have a couple of billion shares outstanding, or a billion and change.
Well, here's a dumb question, Max. Instead of having to, you know, basically shrink the company by, you know, buying the shares back, if you will, and that cash going to the investors and then getting the stock back, why not do a reverse split?
Well, a reverse split usually has a perceptional thing, a negative of its own, because the idea is you almost never see a company do a reverse split unless they're trying to artificially change their stock price for higher,
okay,
so that they can remain listed.
Too obvious.
Well, I mean, I thought that too, but I mean, certainly you could do a two for one. And I don't know why more companies don't consider it. The only reason I can think of is because they don't want somebody to take that headline in a press release and go, oh my goodness, okay, how much trouble must that company be in if they're reverse splitting?
Yeah, it just seems like companies, they make such effort to become widely held. And as you gave the example of Home Depot doing all these splits and reaching more and more investors, and then they've got a reverse course, and they basically are, for our listeners' benefit, they're buying the stock on the open market, right?
Absolutely. And you know, I mean, sometimes they do these accelerated share buybacks so they can get a little bit of a discount, and they can do, you know, they can do some creative things, but I don't have the liberty to personally invest outside of my 401k, but I feel that if I did, I would prefer a stock that returned its capital to shareholders through dividends over buybacks.
Thank you. That's what I'm thinking. I'm going, you're liquidating yourself. I mean, you're giving cash and you're saying, give me back the stock. And when the company does that, they hold it in treasury and it reduces the amount of stock outstanding.
And let's think about it. You are giving back stock, but giving back cash to your shareholders, but which shareholders? The ones who want to leave.
Exactly.
So if you give a dividend, you let me do the decision about how that money gets spent, whether it's a case of microbrewed beer or my daughter's college fund. You let me have the decision-making power with that money. I'm probably going to be happier, especially if you have so many shares outstanding as a result of doing needless and careless splits, you know, in previous decades. And Carol Tomei told me, I asked her if she'd ever, now that their stock price was getting up near our $80, $90 back at all-time highs, whether she would think about doing a stock split. And she said, and I quote, oh, Max, I don't think we will ever do a stock split again. So you know, they've learned their lesson and they've taken that off the table. But, you know, who's to say that it won't work for some companies who are trying to attract, especially household names that mom and pops might relate to more, that really resonate with the consumer, that might have more retail investors in them. Google, for example,
I think you're going to put me to it. That's what I was going to ask you about.
Yeah, the Google's institutional ownership at Google, I think, is only 36%, somewhere thereabouts. So they have a lot of retail investors. But I think that they're of the opinion, they wouldn't talk to me about this, but I would imagine that they're of the opinion that it's an artifice, the practice of doing it just to attract retail investors, even though you've created no fundamental value, is not something that they need to be engaging in. And they do have plenty of shares outstanding already.
Yeah.
So there's also that. They don't need any more liquidity. Sometimes companies will split for a very valid reason. If they find that they've either bought back too much stock or they just have so much interest that they don't have a large enough trading float to cover the activity on a normal day.
That's a good point.
Then a split can be a nice thing. But no, let's also not forget it. The more shares you have outstanding, especially on the NYSE, but also to a certain degree on NASDAQ, the more shares you have outstanding, that is what bases the price that you are going to pay for your annual listing fees.
That's true.
And to a $50 billion company, I'm not sure that $100,000 extra a year on listing fees makes a big deal. But again, as an investor, would I want my company spending that extra $100,000 for only the reasons of splitting its stock?
Good point. Maxwell Murphy of the Wall Street Journal's CFO Journal. Take a quick break. We'll come back.
Have you noticed most of the financial literature available is either so specific it doesn't apply or too generic to answer even the most basic questions? This revelation inspired David Holland to write his first two books, Confessions of a Financial Planner, Secrets to a Secure Retirement, and How to Get Great Advice and Avoid Financial Scams. These how-to guides contain easily accessible information on a wide variety of topics concerning personal finances. An effortless weekend read. You'll find clarification on what a mutual fund is, how to choose the right financial professional, and much more. Call Holland Financial at 888-747-PLAN to request a free excerpt from David's first book, Secrets to a Secure Retirement. The number again is 888-747-7526. Or visit davidholland.com for more information on this innovative book series.
Welcome back, Maxwell Murphy, who also was Dow Jones Newswire's Award Best Columnist of 2003 recipient. Congratulations on that, Max. I know it's been a little while, but hey, all want to have one of those in our on our resume. That's a good one.
Thanks. You've done your homework.
Well, we try. Hey, listen, and never mind that little plant over on your desk. It does not have a microphone in it. let me ask you this. I read your column, your article in the Wall Street Journal, the CFO Journal section, and I read it with great interest, and I was looking at all the names of the different folks you had interviewed for the article, and we had talked before the break about Google, so I have to ask, and of course, if you can comment, great. If you can't, I understand. Any current opinion you have about Apple in terms of maybe they're splitting or maybe a buyback? I know that's been something that's been talked about quite a bit.
Well, we know that Carl Icahn is pushing the company to do a massive, I think, $100 billion share buyback to return value to shareholders, or, you know, that's the pretext. But, of course, that would give a lot of liquidity for investors like Carl Icahn to take their profits and go away, although
sure.
he says he won't. But, you know, I don't have a lot of insight. Google and Apple both play things pretty close to the vest.
Yeah.
You know, you can get them to comment here and there on little things, but in terms of their overall strategy, we don't see it. I feel like with a billion shares outstanding, Peter Oppenheimer at Apple would probably not be too keen on splitting it, but I don't have that under any kind of authority.
Right, right. So a billion shares.
And so, you know, if they were to split and they were to, I mean, they could do a 4 or 5 for 1 stock split or a 6 for 1 and try to get below 100, but then we're talking about a company with 6 billion shares outstanding, which is probably more than any company needs to have, although there are certain companies that don't. But, and you know, and again, you talk about a reverse split when you have that much,
right.
And we talked a little bit about how there's delisting, but if you look, it really didn't work out that great for Citigroup for a while,
mm-hmm.
so there's a stigma about it, and I think companies are careful. Because back in the 80s, you know, Howard Silverblatt, who's a really super smart data guy at S&P Dow Jones Indices, owned by Standard & Poor's, and he was talking about how in the 80s, these things were so important and popular, and companies do them multiple times in 1 year as their stocks soared and soared and soared, that there were actually beeper alerts that you would have so that if you were a trader or an investor, you would know the instant that press release crossed the ticker that there was a stock split, so you could run and buy as much as
Isn't
many shares of the company.
Isn't that interesting? How you ring the bell? Well, but and people saw it as a positive sign back then. I remember that, and people would get so wound up. My stock split 6 for 1. It was as if the stock had reported a 30% jump in profits.
That's exactly right. It was just seen as such a sign of success that you got your stock price got so big that no one could afford you anymore. And here we're going to split it again, and hopefully it's going to get more so expensive again that you won't be able to afford it anymore, and then we'll split it again. And that sort of, until the October 1987 stock market crash, the number went up almost yearly, and it was into the hundreds per year among the S&P 500. But once that crash happened, that really took the sales out. The dot-com bubble, the internet tech bubble that burst around 2000,
yeah.
that almost came, the stock splits almost got back to those kinds of levels, but not quite. But as Howard Silverblatt said, he doesn't think we're ever gonna live to see a world where there are people are making beeper alerts or whatever the current text message or whatever the next generation of beamed into your Google Glass alert that there is a stock split going
on. Well, and maybe the investor now is a little bit more informed. Is that a fair statement? I think they are.
I think probably. I mean, I think any investor who's not informed has more tools available to them, most of them for free, on the internet. You need to pay to get the kind of news we deliver, most of it, but you can find the tools that you need to inform yourself about a decision. And I think just because retail investors are not participating in the market the way they were and institutions have taken over, those institutions at their heart are the fiduciaries for a whole lot of mom and pops out there. And their trading accounts and their mutual funds. So I think that you can never lose sight of the retail investor. But when it's a situation, I don't see anything any catalyst that would send institutions away and cause retail to come back into such prominence that companies are catering to them over the institutions.
That's a fair way to put it, Max. And you mentioned the technology, and I'm remiss not to mention until now the convenience where our listeners can get more information and sign up for your morning ledger email, blogs.wsj.com/CFO. And let's do this, Max. Let's take a quick break, and I want to come back, and I want to ask you what your thoughts are, if you've been hearing anything and following the potential movement on some of the exchanges from a penny to the nickel trade, and get some thoughts there. So let's stay right there and come right back.
Great.
What's your dream? Play golf every day of the week? Turn that hobby into a new career? With careful planning, you can make it happen. Call 888-747-PLAN to schedule your no-obligation consultation. At Holland Financial, we want to help you take the first step towards making your dreams a reality. That number again is 888-747-7526.
And welcome back. If you'd like to sign up for that morning ledger email, you can get a good read on the biggest news stories of the previous day and what will be the biggest stories of the day to come, I suppose, or the current day at least. Let's look at that blog, blogs.wsj.com/CFO. We're rejoined by Maxwell Murphy, our guest today, and he is the Maxwell Murphy of the Wall Street Journal, CFO Journal, and wrote a great column that I saw in the Wall Street Journal, part of my daily read campaign. It starts usually at 5 in the morning, but that's okay. That's the price we pay, right, Max?
Indeed.
So I kind of set it up before the break. I wanted to ask you if you've been following and you have any opinion about some of the talk I'm hearing about this increasing the size of the increments of the trades. Have you been looking at that?
You know, I have not been following it closely, but I have heard what is being bandied about, and I do have some thoughts on it.
Yeah, share them with us.
When I first started covering Wall Street back as a Cub reporter in late 1999 and early 2000, the stock quotes were still given with fractions.
Right.
And from a writing point of view, that's kind of a pain, and it's very makes for very ugly looking copy when you, with all of the eighths and sixteenths and 32nds and 64ths that you would sometimes have to go down to, depending on what kind of calculations you were making. That I very much embraced the move to decimalization and down to the penny. I have read some of the negative literature that we just don't need to be trading in the penny, and that it creates too little of an opportunity to capture money on trades for brokers. But you know, as somebody who's writing for investors, I'm not really I don't really care too much for things that are intended only to make brokers more commissions. But I think that there might be some good in going to a nickel. I don't think any good would be served by going back to fractions. Let's face it, it's a sad state of affairs, but the country is not getting any more numerate than it is now. And I think that would confuse some people who aren't as into numbers and wonky stuff as I am.
Fair point.
But I guess that if going by increments of 5 cents would help, I wouldn't be against it. I just, as always, the other problem I always had with the fractions is that I don't like when there are fractions of cents, which once you get past half into eighth, then you have cents that are measured beyond two decimal places. And
It gives you a headache, right?
Not only does it give you a headache, it creates that kind of world that they talk about in that comedy Office Space, where you can create a program that captures all the fractional cents and that have somehow disappeared into limbo and put that into your own bank account.
So, that's Brewster's Millions. That's Brewster's.
That's exactly right, too. Brewster's Millions. I remember that as a kid.
I'm sorry. It's not Brewster's Millions. It's from Superman, and that's when he gets recruited to help figure out the technology to fight
that's
Superman.
That's right. You were thinking Brewster's Millions. That's the Inheritance, but you were thinking Brewster's Millions because Richard Pryor was
If you have never seen those two movies, Max and I both think they're great.
they indeed are.
Well, as long as we don't go back, Max, to the... we start talking about fractions and decimals and nickels. As long as I don't go to 2 bits, 4 bits, 6 bits, a dollar, I'm okay.
I'm okay too. It really, as somebody who likes to see the world kind of in black and white, especially covering the world of CFOs, it is a world of absolutes. They don't like any gray area. They want to know one way or another what something is or is not. And so, to the extent that having decimalization down to the penny, and so that stocks can trade just like something on your grocery store shelves, I can't see what the harm in that is.
There's not, although I would love for them to get rid of pennies at the grocery store.
that's really true. They should. It is quite a waste. And Canada's got rid of its penny, or is getting rid of if they haven't already. So I would like to
no
see
more
that.
Loonies.
As far as I understand, no.
But they're going to have toonies still, right?
I believe so. Okay. Yes.
Go from a loonie to a toonie. All right.
Exactly. And I've always thought it would be simpler if groceries were forced to calculate the tax into their prices, so that whatever was marked on the store shelves was inclusive of tax, so that you could do the numbers calculation in your head much easier than having to at the end multiply by, if you're lucky, a few percent in some states, or if you live in New York, whatever it is, 35%. I'm kidding; it's only about 8 or 10, but it is up there.
Well, Max and I are certainly cut from some of the same cloth here, because I think of how many times I look at the price and go, really, why can't you just make it 94 or 93 cents so that when I give you a dollar, we're good?
Totally, and it really actually kind of does circle back to the stock split discussion. Yeah. It's the psychology of spending, the psychology of investing that isn't, it's not pseudo, well, it's kind of pseudoscience, but that's not to say that it's not very real and plausible. And if retailers didn't realize that a customer was more likely to pay $9.99 for something than they were to pay $10, they would stop doing it.
They got us. They got our number, don't they?
They totally do.
All right. Well, Maxwell Murphy of the Wall Street Journal's CFO Journal, and the blog is blogs.wsj.com/CFO. Maxwell Murphy, you're a good guy, Max. I appreciate you being on the program, and it was very helpful, and we'll have to have you back.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed it anytime you'd like.
I'd love that. Thank you very much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Want to learn more about Real Money with David Holland? Visit us at realmoneyradio.com, where you can listen live or to the archives. You can also email us your questions, comments, or show ideas to info@realmoneyradio.com. Be sure to like us on Facebook at Real Money with David Holland.
Remember, nobody cares more about your money than you do. This has been Real Money with David Holland. Thank you for listening.